All right, everybody, welcome back to This Week in Startup. With me, Lon Harris. I'm Jason Calacanis. We have a full docket on Fridays. We like to expand a little bit our horizons, talk to maybe some businesses that aren't strictly software-based inside your computer, maybe talk to some entrepreneurs, and we have a really cool one that Rory Sutherland inspired called Flat White. Or
we should say F off, I think.
F off. Flat white or F off?
I'm going to say F off so we don't get YouTube, we don't get booted off of YouTube. Yeah.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Northwest Registered Agent. Get more when you start your business with Northwest. In 10 clicks and 10 minutes, you can form your company and walk away with a real business identity. Learn more at northwestregisteredagent.com/twist. Whisperflow. Stop typing. Dictate with Whisperflow and send clean final draft writing in seconds. Visit whisperflow.ai/twist to get started for free today. That's whisperflow.ai/twist. And LinkedIn Jobs. Hire right the first time. Post your job and get $100 off towards your job post at linkedin.com/twist.
Before we get started here, we want to make sure we don't lose any of these gems. We have a lot of things we'll talk about during the show, and we tape the show live, and we like to banter a little bit before the show. We'll have a little banter in between that we cut out of the final podcast while we're queuing things up. If you don't want to lose any of those nuggets, any of those action items, any of your inspiration or ideas, get a plot pin, and then you just press the button. Boom, it vibrates. You get a nice haptic. It starts recording. Red light. Everybody knows that you're recording. You may have heard me before. Hey, I'm into privacy. So I say, hey, may I record our meeting? Or hey, is anybody else using a meeting recorder? Mm-hmm. It's now kind of table stakes. When you go into a meeting, you expect it to be recorded for AI.
Right.
So, hey, that train's left the station. It provides massive value. Everybody understands when you're in a meeting, you know, Zoom records it, everybody's recording it. But this one, the plug pin, puts it right on your lapel. So when I'm skiing or, you know, I'm in meetings, I don't have to like grab my device and fire up some other app. Hit the settings. Nope, just boop, press it. And then it delightfully will make me a summary. Sometimes I'll take that summary. I'll just send a link to Lon and say, hey, this is for the talk I'm doing in 2 weeks. Some ideas for you. Boom. And then he has something to build from.
Unlike a lot of these note takers, it understands a lot of the context of what you're saying. So it's not just like a wall of text that you have to go through and dig through. It fixes your grammar and punctuation. It organizes everything neatly. It looks like a human sat next to you and actually took diligent notes, but it was just your plot pin.
Man, they also have one that goes in the back of your phone that I love. So I carry both of these things with me, and I travel a lot internationally, and I am popping out of meetings with my team all the time, and bang, this thing makes me so much more productive. You know, I still will like to have my pen and my pad here sometimes.
Sure. The old ways never die.
It never dies, but I find myself using it half as much.
You should check it out at plaud.ai/twist and use the code twist, and they're going to give you 10% off.
Let's get to the show.
It's our very first entry in our new series, Tau plus AI. We're going to be talking to some of the very top BitTensor subnets. We talked to Mark Jeffrey, of course, of Steelcore Capital last week. Got really excited about Tau, BitTensor, this whole ecosystem. So we've got Mog and Dubs here, the co-founders of Hippias Subnet 75. That's the decentralized blockchain-powered cloud storage platform. It's sort of like a decentralized AWS or Google Cloud. So they're gonna come on now and show us around.
You know, Tau is very similar in a distributed fashion. Mog and Dubs, welcome. It's an inspiring project because I remember having Bitcoin on this very podcast in, I think, 2010 or 2009, 2010, 2011, right in that time period.
It was 2011.
I was inspired by it. 2011?
Yes.
Super inspired by it because it was, so very decentralized and nobody in control. And you had this ability to move money around and store value. And then maybe it would work for transactions. Maybe there'd be other uses for it. It turned out there was only one real use: speculation, store of value, you know, and maybe if you're trying to get from out of one country to another, Lon, and you got a thumb drive and, you know, you're leaving Venezuela, you're trying to get back on track and you're trying to keep your assets as you're leaving a dictatorship to go flee. You know, there's like some really interesting uses for Bitcoin. What I found really interesting about the BitTensor project, Lon, is that instead of using the compute to solve cryptography problems to create this network that allowed for the storage of assets. This one allows you to take all of that work and put it towards something productive in the world. And
right.
At the same time, and BitTensor's been around for a while, at the same time, you know, it started to get some, you know, early true believers. The AI revolution happened. And then the need for compute happened and is happening right now. We're soaking in it, the data center build out. And people buying Mac Studios to run OpenClaw. We need more compute. We need more, infrastructure. And Tao and BitTensor feels like the perfect platform for that. So Mog and Dubs, tell me how you found out about this BitTensor project. What inspired you to get involved in it, and what have you built?
It's actually fantastic to see so many people getting excited about it. I'm glad that Mark was on explaining you a lot of the basics. My history love affair with BitTensor sounds much like yours, only it's a couple of years older. And I remember, I'll do this briefly, but discovering BitTensor in the early days of GPT 2.5 and understanding the power of using distributed compute and distributed participation to essentially produce either a mixture of experts or to provide a better solution than calling out inference to a single provider, be it OpenAI, Meta, et cetera. And this was very early on, but what I also saw was that a lot of the very bright people that were building in this space weren't the best suited to deliver product and understand what really connected with users. And we saw an opening at that time that was really needed was the ability to visualize the network. And so we created TaoStats, which is essentially a blockchain explorer and data analytics for the network. It now provides all of the trading to go in and out of subnets. It's the one site that anyone in BitTensor uses and probably has double-figure tabs open on their desktop. Not here to big up TaoStats. I think I've just managed to do that my mind already. And then when subnets came into fruition, subnets being the ability for anyone to go and build their own incentive mechanism to generate their own commodity, because in the early days of BitTensor, there was only one. Everyone was working towards one particular commodity value. One of the real needs for the network was storage. And a couple of people tried and failed to get storage right. And Dubs was working with me on TaoStats, helping with the architecture there. And it transpired that he had an incredible history with both node operation and decentralized storage. I think it takes a certain type of person and work ethic to build a subnet. You have to have thick skin, be very, very multi-spectrum talented across, and also be prepared to be learning as you go. This is new technology. This incentive mechanism design is not something that really exists in production in such a way, and you're building on an ever-evolving network. And so we set about to create Hippias. Hippias is, as Lon alluded, essentially AWS, Google Cloud, R2 on distributed decentralized infrastructure. Storage initially being perfected. Essentially, the major product now is a drop-in replacement for S3. Sorry, Amazon, we're coming after you.
And for people who don't know, Amazon has a product called S3. Basically, if you need storage, you can just pay them a fee and you get a terabyte. And so with your project, you pay a fee, you get a terabyte, and that terabyte, instead of being in an Amazon data center, is where?
All around. It is distributed between the participants. I'll switch over to Dubs in a minute for the technical side of it, but the essentially distributed with fail safes. So you often see this from time to time because many people understand that S3 probably powers, I would guess, 60% of storage and products on the internet. And very often when you have these huge network outages for the internet, it's usually one of two things that have gone down. Cloudflare, bless them, they are amazing, or an S3 data center or pipeline somewhere. And suddenly you've got, you know, American Express is out, MasterCard is out, and all these other services are out. Yeah. Netflix isn't working for a couple of hours. And of course, they're hugely important infrastructure providers within the internet. But much like so much of the evolution of what we're doing, by distributing and decentralizing it, we create these fail-safes.
For startups, every single hire matters, but posting an ad and sorting through all the applications, it can be a huge drain on your time and resources, don't I know it? But thankfully, there's LinkedIn Hiring Pro. That's right, our friends at LinkedIn are going to help you hire with confidence faster than ever before. For example, we're hiring new editors here for the pod and reviewing all these reels and applications. This can get overwhelming very quickly. We know what we're looking for. It's just a matter of tracking them down. Hiring Pro streamlines the entire process, helping us quickly draft a perfect job post, then using AI to shortlist candidates and even conduct initial interviews so we can zero in on the best overall applications right away. Nearly 60% of companies find a quality candidate within their first week. So hire right the first time and get $100 off your first job posting by going to linkedin.com/twist. Terms and conditions apply.
Who are the people who've contributed their hard drive space to the network? And then I guess maybe you could walk us through how it gets distributed and what the performance is like. Because if the hard drives are all in one data center with a massive pipe into it and Amazon has all that, I would assume that they're going to outperform a distributed network, which has to piece together and maybe it doesn't have the throughput or the speed. Or am I wrong? Maybe have you architected it to be faster or just cheaper? So usually you get like a couple of those things. It's either faster and, you know, more stable, but not cheaper, or it's cheaper and stable, but not as fast. You know, when you're talking about storage, you get to pick two. So how does it work? And then who's contributing the storage, Dubs?
I will try to be not too technical, but basically we created a protocol ourselves, which is called Arion. And we made it from the ground up. We started on the basics, on distributing everything to the miners. And we select the miners using incentive mechanism. So basically the incentive mechanism is something you design and it constantly change over the time. Because you want to have some performance in some point, you get the performance you have already for some stuff. And that's the beauty of BitTensor, is like you can modulate your algorithm or your incentive mechanism to get the miners adapting what you need. For example, you need like to have more speed, you will put more effort on waiting more on the speed of the network, so you can have more more throughput. But the way we did it, because like the big question would be, yeah, cool, but what if the team goes down or stuff like that? I trust more Amazon. We developed something that is crash map. Also, we get the crash map and we adapted it for the decentralized storage, which is basically mathematics. You can calculate exactly where your fire is on which miner it is. And everything is backed by the blockchain. We have a blockchain for APIs that we run, and we write everything as a log, if you want, in the blockchain, so you can explore where your fire is, how it goes.
All right, so to translate that for the audience maybe who isn't as technical, when you set up a subnet, you get to define how people earn their tokens on that. And what you can decide if you're doing one based on storage is saying, hey, I care about uptime. So in order to earn the tau and to get tokens as being part of this, you need to have a certain level of uptime. You need a certain level of speed. So I need this amount of throughput. If you don't hit those things, you can't participate. Or if you're faster, maybe you can participate at a higher level. But that's what the tau platform allows you to do, correct?
Yeah, what we're doing is designing an incentive mechanism that's very fluid. So you can actually adjust that to say, as Dub said, hey, I need the miners to be faster. It's great. We've got all the storage. The latency is fine, but we're suffering a bit on speed. Let's push miners to optimize for speed.
And so then they can say wherever they're storing it. And I want to ask this question for the third or fourth time. Who's contributing the hard drive space? Because that's what like somebody wants to know. So let's get that out of the way right
Anyone
now.
Anyone with redundant storage who has the expertise to optimize for the incentive mechanism. So it is not mom and pops at home with an extra 20 gig on their hard disk. It is usually people with data centers or infrastructure. You could technically be doing it at home. But I would say that currently it's those that understand BitTensor, they're able to read an incentive mechanism and optimize their setup for it. But it can be anyone. That is the beauty.
It's open to anyone. It's permissionless then. But you do need to have, as a prerequisite, Lon, knowledge of BitTensor.
Yeah.
You have to be highly technical to be able to go read the incentive structures and
right.
align with that and build that software. And you need to have, you know, hard drive space that would make it worth joining this, which
right.
I'm going to read into it. If you must know some of the people who put storage on the network, Mog, or you must have like asked some friends maybe to seed it. Would these be data center people? Like, are they?
No. In the early days, BitTensor miners are a strong community, and we got a lot of feedback from them. But the reality of BitTensor is most people are optimizing for incentives. So they'll do anything they can, including cheat, to maximize incentive, which is very good for making sure your incentive mechanism
okay.
is
okay. So bulletproof. It's ruthless. Show me an incentive. Yeah. I'll show you the outcome. They might go find and do arbitrage. There might be some data storage company that is doing a sale on, you know, storage, and they buy that, put
oh,
it into the network
right.
to leverage that. And they're just constantly on the lookout for cheap storage, and they're going to optimize for that.
Yes, but we can, of course, score for reliability and continuous
sure.
uptime and metrics and such. So, yes, but all we right, don't know. So the answer to that is no, we don't have a closed circle of people that we know.
Okay.
The miners that mostly get in contact with you are those that are complaining about something.
So then let's talk a little bit, Dubs, about who's using this. So how long has Hippus been offering storage? And how many people are contributing storage, like the total number of people contributing storage? And how many people, you know, in the last 30 days have used storage, let's say?
You have 256 slots on BitTensor. It's UI, the UIG, where the miners can bring storage in. We make something that we can split that. So basically, maybe Morgs would be better to explain that, you are able to have a family and then bring more server to it to make a cluster. So every miner is able to bring a cluster and make redundancy between his own nodes.
Okay, so that's what is yeah. technically possible. My question, how many people are providing storage currently? Because I know these projects are nascent, they're very young. So how long has the network been offering storage, and then how many people have contributed storage so far? You must know those numbers, even if you don't know who they are, right?
I'll grab it. You can actually go to HIP stats and see a lot of this. But because we have, which is the network explorer for Hippius, and as we've evolved, we've just implemented Arion recently to get rid of a huge amount of redundancy. So there was a perceived drop in files stored, but you can see there currently 351 terabytes stored of storage available. And what we're doing at the moment is onboarding large sort of subnets within BitTensor as our core test audience. But what we're doing is appealing to developers who are already using AWS as just a simple drop-in to replace what it is that they're doing. So obviously the requirements are pretty simple. It has to work as good as, and of course it's cheaper.
Got it. So the answer to my question, we have 351 terabytes online. Across,
yes.
I love the fact that this is all transparent, because now you get to see the network growing, and you know you can build confidence in it. So when we're looking at this, Lon, we have 350 terabytes up and running. Okay, it's a modest amount, but these are nascent projects, as I've said, and that's what we do here at This Week in Startups, is we try to get on things very early so that we can understand them. And this is super disruptive. There is 100% of the nodes are online. Then we have total tau burned. Is that what that is there?
Yes. I actually spoke to Dubs about this. I don't know if I like this metric or not. within BitTensor, there's a lot of conversation around a term that I actually coined called alphanomics. And I don't know how deep you want to get into this, but every project within BitTensor, every subnet has its own alpha token. And the way that BitTensor's flow of emissions is designed, in layman's terms, is it will not reward wastage. So you can't just say, hey, you know, the investors in BitTensor think my project is worth 5%, so I'm just throwing that to all my miners. So we were one of the very first projects to say, hey, you know what? We're only paying the miners for what is used. So although our miners get 41% of our emissions, we only actually pay out for the used storage, which directly translates to revenue. There's no free storage on Hippius unless we decide to pay for it on your behalf if you happen to be a startup.
Lon, this is going to be one of our big questions. Hey, which subnets should you own tokens on, and right. which subnets are being run by the most sophisticated entrepreneurs, or are they being run by hippies who just want to change the world, or is there an investment opportunity, or is it a nonprofit? These things can be anything, you know, based on, you know, when I've talked to Mark.
Sure.
So we have to then validate the nodes as investors, and then also as, you know, just strategically, where are these going to go? So there was another line at the top there. Explain to me what the final number there is in that row. I want to tell you about a product I'm obsessed with, and everyone in tech seems to be obsessed with. It's called WhisperFlow, W-I-S-P-R Flow. You set it up, and then you hit a key combination and you talk, and it transcribes what you say. It does it more accurately and quicker and across all your platforms than any other speech to text software I've ever used. When you communicate all day long, like I do, even as a fast typist, it is going to be 3, 4, 5 times faster than you can type. And because it fixes all of your ums and your ahs and your mistakes and cleans it up, all of the punctuation, all of the filler and unnecessary words being removed in real time, WhisperFlow is already available everywhere. When I'm using it in Superhuman, Gmail, Slack, Google Docs, I use it everywhere. The messages sound like I wrote them. We're moving into a world where agents are going to make us 100 times more efficient. Now you add WhisperFlow, making you 5, 10, 20 times more efficient. Visit whisperflow.ai/twist to get started for free today. This product's amazing. That's WhisperFlow.ai/twist. I've been using this product for 6 months. It is extraordinary. Now there's a number next to that, 488-7427.
Yes.
So what's interesting here is Hippias is the first and only BitTensor subnet that has its own blockchain. This could go down a whole rabbit hole of my BitTensor expertise, but essentially the BitTensor blockchain records only the incentive that subnets, essentially the incentive landscape, the current scoring and transactions within the BitTensor blockchain. And that was not enough to have verifiable on-chain storage for a storage network. So we created the first subnet to have its own substrate blockchain. But aligning with the principles of BitTensor, this was pre-subnets having alpha tokens, so not having its own secondary token, not trying to extract value from BitTensor Tau. Of course, as things evolve, now all subnets have their own token. But in short, that's the block number for the Hippias blockchain.
Okay, and then you can click on miners here, and we get a rank, and we see the weight. Where do we see like the total number of miners, and what's the point of this heads-up display?
As Dubs explained, what happens is that although there are 256 slots available, that's like saying I'm going to limit my business to having 256 suppliers. I don't need more than that. However, each supplier can have their own sub-supply chain but you are only interfacing with 256. So what you see there is child. And what will actually be happening, which is not quite in place yet, is as network expands and demand expands, miners will compete and have more and more child nodes. So there'll still be 256 slots, but let's say you need to provide more storage in order to compete, you may need 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 child nodes.
So you're building a team
exactly.
In order to move up the rankings. And so 256, you know, a standard number in compute, it's, you know, 2, 4, 8,
I mean, we have to speak a little bit about the evolution. This started as an IPFS network. And we basically pushed IPFS to its limits, especially in terms of what developers needed in terms of absolute latency, immediate availability. I'm not going to go into the issues of IPFS, but as a result, and as happens with BitTensor thinking on your feet and realigning, this Arian upgrade, which is unique to Hippias, was built in order to solve so many of the problems of decentralized storage so that it is as fast as AWS.
And IPFS, for people who don't know, is kind of like a protocol, like HTTP will be the, you know, sending you your web pages. And what's interesting about this is you can see how much they've stored, how much bandwidth. And then there's a final column there, strikes. Is strikes good or bad? Strikes in baseball is you missed. So what's a strike?
Strike is never good. Dubs, what's a strike?
Well, basically, behind the scene, we have something that runs a ZK proof, because you cannot like proof every miner to know if they have everything. So you send them a computation, you ask them to calculate something, and if they don't calculate it correctly, that means they miss a file, they doesn't download it fast enough or transfer it fast enough to have, so they get a strike. If they are not up or not able to provide a file when you download it, they get a strike. You need to know that basically your files, when you send the files to Hippius, it's divided in 30 chunks. Everything is erasure coded. So basically we could lose 60% of the network. We should be able to serve still the file. Because that's the biggest problem with decentralized storage. Miners come and go. You need to save the files, and you need to be able to reconstruct the files. So that's what we did, and that's why we put this mechanism in place. So we can judge the miner, expose the proof to the users, and they can see it. And even miners can know where they are good or bad and improve.
How long have you had the network up and running? Obviously, this is a very nascent technology. This is super inspiring. You could take, you know, thousands of participants around the world who work at data centers or have extra server capacity could be competing here to put their unused storage or finding storage that's super cheap in China, in Malaysia. Somebody's got a data center lawn and they got access to a bunch of, you know, close out hardware and servers. Yeah. They bought them at a discount. They racked them, they stacked them, and they had free electricity from a hydro dam. This was kind of like the story of Bitcoin. People went and found the cheapest power. Right. They went and found the cheapest compute, and they then won the game of making a Bitcoin. Here, the game is what's the cheapest I can put storage onto the Hippus network.
So to answer the first question, how long has it been going? Just almost exactly a year, just under a year. But in that time, as you can see on these graphs, there has been a huge evolution. As I say, initially with IPFS, what happened is we had at least five copies of everything, and miners, bless them, decided that as they were being rewarded for the storage that they were serving, they essentially started uploading huge amounts of data to the network to try and optimize their scoring metrics, which was not particularly helpful.
They were like, hey, I put the storage up here, let me see how it works. They wanted to make sure that the game was and the flywheel was going, but they weren't.
If you're being
paid
for the amount of storage that you're putting up and it's costing you less to use that storage and you're being paid for supplying it, then yes, you have a little bit of a feedback loop issue there.
An incentive, right? We're back to incentives. If there's nobody using the storage, I'm going to just back up all my photos times 10 just to fill up the storage because I've figured out the arbitrage, right? So there's arbitrage in all of these Tau networks and just all the subnets, and Tau itself is arbitrage, right?
Correct.
That's the actual beautiful thing, Lon. It's the virtuous thing is that everybody is doing that arbitrage incessantly. Yeah, you could have moments where people are doing it non-productively, is I think what you're saying.
What's happened is the Arian update that's been deployed, I mean, I think probably in total in the back end of month, but really being pushed in the last few weeks with some supporting applications. And for this, I'm talking about Pull Weights and Hermes, which Dubs will talk about. Pull Weights is essentially Hugging Face, but built on BitTensor. And Hermes is something that I'm hoping Dubs will explain, but it's essentially huge data transfer specifically for models orientated around BitTensor, but can be used outside of BitTensor. And now what's happening is we've been working with a lot of subnets and satisfying the needs of their development teams. And we've reached this point now where suddenly everyone is coming back and going, this is great. This is working exactly how I need it. Thank you, guys. So I sometimes would like to reset all of this, these graphs and say, hey, can we start from a couple of weeks ago? that wouldn't be fair to do. And I think the history is important. Yeah, but as there is a note on
and
this
transparency. Any questions here about where this is all going? And obviously, this is just a starting point. We're just trying to learn here on This Week in Startups about this, not financial advice. We don't know I'm an investor in Mark Jeffries Fund. And a partner there so that I can learn. Sometimes I invest to learn. Other times I learn and invest. This is a clearly invest, get my attention and then learn, Lon. That's what I'm doing here. And these are all nascent projects. I can't tell you which subnet's going to work, which one, where the value will accrue, where the most participation is. But we just want to learn. And this is one that was like super interesting to us. But any questions, Lon, from you or insights?
It's easier than ever to build a great new product. And launching a startup, even as a solopreneur, is getting easier and easier. But as my experienced founders already know, there's a lot more to starting a company than just putting up a website or even building a product. If you're serious about going into business, you need a Delaware C Corp. That's going to give you a serious leg up on your competition, and you can be taken seriously by investors. That's where Northwest Registered Agent comes in. Just a few clicks, they're going to give you the perfect start to your new enterprise. A real identity, a domain, a custom website, a business email, all the public filings done, and even a phone number. And you'll complete this process in under 10 minutes. Plus, you're going to get all sorts of free tools and resources, from step-to-step guides, compliance reminders, and an online account that's going to keep everything organized, even as your business grows. So get all the advantages of a Delaware C Corp, regardless of where in the U.S. you're operating out of. NorthwestRegisteredAgent.com/twist.
I mean, we were sort of talking about it, like how much this is almost like a marketplace for storage. Like, are you concerned in general about like unit economics? Like how many tokens do we need to give miners to make it worth them? Like, because I know you're trying to, you know, undercut the AWSs of the world. Like, how much of your sort of work is going into like thinking about like how Uber would, like, well, the drivers have to make enough to make it worth driving, and passengers has to be cheap enough for them to be willing to take. Like, are you thinking a lot about it as a marketplace like that?
Yes and no. You see, because of the BitTens incentivized infrastructure and the distributed nature, the miners will always compete to undercut the AWSs and the R2s of the world. It's a given. And we already significantly, and if you actually go to just hippias.com and look at the front page there, which is a little bit more hippias, you can see the price calculator, and you can work out, if you go to pricing, for yourself the price difference for what your storage needs. Actually, the main focus is not on needing to provide the miners providing the storage. At this point, it's about getting the confidence of the developers and the users, right, splitting our time between developer-orientated functionality through API, through code, and then also that balance, which is something I feel quite strongly about, which is the consumer side. I remember speaking to Raoul Paul last year about this, and he said, look, come back to me when I can literally do a one-click replacement for my Dropbox. That's always been my thing. Replace Dropbox, replace Nextcloud, own cloud, or anything like that. And there is a console that you can see where you can literally go on, you can select it, and you can upload data immediately from your computer. You know, I have 50 gig from my desktop that's stored on here that I access all the time. I actually use this as the backup and file system for my CloudBot.
Very smart. So Hippias's software is an open source project?
There are elements of it. The miner code is open source because the miners are forced to iterate. There are large elements of it that are open source, and then there are some proprietary parts to it.
And is it a private company, a nonprofit project? Are you two the CEO and CTO? Tell me about the corporate structure, yeah.
Hippias is part of a private company. It was incubated by the parent company of Taustats, who have incubated a number of subnets, of which I am the CEO.
What's the name of your company?
Taustats is the main operating name. The actual parent company is called T34, which is a company incorporated in Dubai. And because so much of BitTens is done on the fly from a corporate structure, the aim is to have Hippias on its own feet as an individual entity. We've been very, very lucky, and it's always been a belief in mine, is to prolong equity and release of equity until you really accrue value within your company. I've never been a fan of just selling ideas and a dream. I would rather sell provable value. And I know that when that time comes, Hippias will have to be a standalone corporate entity. It's in the roadmap for 2026, but the ability to support and iterate fast has taken priority, which has got us to where we are. So all subnets and BitTensor itself follow the same tokenomic principles as Bitcoin, all fair launch, no pre-mines. No ICO deals. There are many subnets who have raised equity through private companies. We haven't. the subnets that we incubate are fortunate enough that we can allow them not to have to go down that route, because I personally believe selling equity in your business too early on is a negative.
I love that, by the way. It's a great startup founder approach, a very mature one, which is, hey, let's make sure there's some value here before we start taking capital. Of course, there are some people like myself who love to give risk capital knowing, hey, 90% chance. Mog.
We used to have that offered to us early on, and I would turn around to the investors and say, you know what I'm going to do with your capital? I'm just going to buy Tao.
Right, exactly. And this is also complicated, which is why I partnered with Mark on Stillcore, because I knew he knew you, and he is spending literally 14 hours a day trying to figure this out. And you could tell from
all the time, yeah.
Well, we're going to just keep asking questions here and having the leaders in Tao and BitTensor come on the program. Mog, Dubs, thank you so much for sharing the project.
Yeah, this was amazing.
Really interesting. And we'll have you back on again in, I think, maybe 3 months and talk more. And then when I'm in Dubai, Mog, I come to the region for Founder University in Riyadh every 6 months or so. And so next time I come by, I'll definitely come and let's go to O'Farrelly Brothers. Have you been to that place, O'Farrelly Brothers?
Oh, I haven't.
In Dubai? Oh, yeah. That's a place in Dubai?
Yeah, it's a really great chef who's on TV. He's like a TV chef, but he's got
sure
a really great...
In Dublin,
it's a Jordanian. I think it's Jordanian. This is O'Farrelly Brothers. Let me show you this, Lon.
Yes, O'Farrelly Brothers, I think, is how you do it.
Yes, O'Farrelly Brothers. Yeah. My man in the region took me here, Zafar. And these guys are like TV chefs or whatever. These brothers are incredible chefs. One of the great meals of my life. And you can see they got every award you can imagine.
I'm reading. They're not only do they have a Michelin star, they're in the Michelin Guide as one of the world's 50 best restaurants in the world.
Yeah.
That's not an easy thing to get.
And you go there and I'm showing you a couple here, Lon, but when I went there, they were... The guy, they talked me up before I got there, right? Oh, sure. Jason Calacanis is coming, yada, yada. Yeah. So that was very nice. And then they start doing this. They start bringing out like the Barry Wine beggar's purses kind of situation on, these incredible array of pedestals and whatnot. And they have this foie gras on a cloud surf dome. And,
presentation.
If
you're going to crack the Michelin top 50, it's beyond just everything tastes really good. It's beyond just great service. They take care of you. It has to be beautiful. It has to be like a work of art on a plate, really.
Right. And this is the guy. Like if I lived there, we'd be best friends because we just vibe totally. He's got those crazy glasses like me. And we literally just sat for an hour and talked food, and the restaurant's beautiful. Here's the restaurant, really tall, iconic restaurant. You had a ton of choices, Lon. One after the next was more inspiring. You know, that's like one type of experience.
Right.
You know, it's another type of experience.
Just one. You got one choice.
Just one.
Yeah.
But really well.
Right.
One done great. Or you're going for the Michelin star and you're creating a 16 course. My friend, Rory Sutherland, who's been on this podcast a number of times, he works in marketing. He did like a clip.
Podcast. He was on Jamie Lang's podcast. Okay. He's an iconic British ad executive and author, former vice chairman of Ogilvy and Mather. And so he was having this exact same conversation. He was saying he's tired of Starbucks. He's tired of these kinds of places. You always end up in this long line. Everybody in front of you is getting the double half frappuccino with mocha.
Two pumps.
Light ice. Kind of crazy thing. He's like, venting. I'm in a hurry. I'm a commuter. I just want my coffee to get. I got places to be.
Yes.
So he was saying his dream. He's imagining it on a podcast. He's saying his dream would be a business called Flat White or Fuck Off. And you're only there to get a flat white. It's an orderly and quick and easy process to get a delicious flat white. He was just throwing this out another idea. But three guys who are listening, Charlie Hurst, Tom Noble, and Will Sudlow, they have turned this, Jason, into a brand and a business. And we have them here to talk to us about it today. Welcome to the Flat White or F Off guys.
Let me just start by telling all of you blokes to fuck off for taking this genius idea from Rory. I hope you cut him into the cap table. Is this a pop-up, a put-on, a publicity stunt, or a real business? And I don't know who speaks for the company here. You got three founders. That's a red flag. But okay, who's in charge here? Who makes the final decision? Who speaks for the group?
Well, it's everything all at once.
We all speak at the same time.
You know. Yeah, we always
I knew this was going to happen.
I think, it's everything that you've said there, really, all at once. I think we're taking this journey as it comes and sort of rolling with the punches, which I know in your guys' world is probably absolutely insane, but we don't really do things like traditional businesses, and we sort of own that, really. But yeah, you know, Rory gave us his blessing, and we're trying to do the best with that blessing and make something pretty spectacular, hopefully.
No, wait, who saw Rory on the podcast? Which one of you? By the way, that's Charlie Hurst talking right now. So Charlie, seem like you're the leader. You're the CEO.
I'm just the gobshite. I'm just the one.
Will's got problems. I can tell Will's going for this. Will's going for the throne. Fuck off, Flatline. Fuck off.
Yeah, so I saw the clip. I saw the clip, and I'm a freelance graphic designer, so I build brands for a living. That's what I do as part of my business. And I saw the clip and thought, that's a great brief that no one's really touched. I wonder what would happen if you tried to bring some visuals and sort of a brand idea to life of Rory's joke. Because again, you know, he has all these great business ideas. He's a man of many mad ideas. But no one's really ever tried to take that and build it into something. So it was just meant to be a bit of fun, you know.
So you designed the iconic logo and the cup.
I did. Yes, indeed.
Which is what first drew me to it. I was on one of my social feeds, and Rory and I are friends. It's been on the pod a number of times, and I see the iconic cup go by, and I hear his voice. So I stop on anytime he's doing like a little micro lesson. I'm like, oh, I got to stop in here. Rory's always got something interesting to say. But then I see the cup. But it's playful and fun. It's cheeky, Charlie.
I think I've got the cup somewhere, actually.
Well, here,
I've got
the cup on my shelf. Here it is.
You can see it right there next to a Johnny.
And it's got a star, you know, in the U. So, you know, with all these books that have the F off. Tell me about, you build the brief, and then these are your mates, I take it? Tom and Will are your mates? Or these are just randos that
We hate each other, really. No, we didn't know each other before this started. So I put it on LinkedIn just as a little PR piece, and then that got the attention of Mr. Tom Noble, who enters the story.
Got it. Okay, so Tom,
so we are all randos online.
You're online randos, but
just
apparently with some skills.
Who found each
Charlie's
other.
Got the design skills. He makes something iconic. He puts it online. He's of action in the world, Lon. As I always tell young people who are like, how do I make it? I'm just like, make something. You're either
just
creating or you're waiting. Yeah. You're creating or you're waiting. That was something Kevin Pollak told me. So now what's your involvement, Tom? You're just, you got no job and you're sitting there scrolling, looking for something to do? What happened?
So I build websites and tech. That's the day job. And then I decided, like last year, I wanted to get into the content creation. So I saw this. I wanted to make
sure. So you're unemployed.
Videos about building.
You're unemployed. Got it. Keep
going. Isn't
you're
everyone
website
really?
Builder. Exactly. We're all the same.
Freelance
unemployed website builder.
Sounds a great job. Guys. I didn't do anything. It's over.
I'm AI. Who knows?
All right. So Tom, you're looking
for. So I reached out to him.
I
reached out to him because I wanted to make some videos. Just a LinkedIn messenger. I just said, that's cool. Do you want to do it? And I didn't know who he was, Charlie.
So just
and, he got
and
back.
And where
to
are
me.
You? You're in London?
No, I'm based in Cheltenham, which is 2 hours away from London. Charlie's actually based in Sheffield, which is 2 hours north of London.
Okay, so you guys can't even afford to live in London. You guys are in the burbs.
Absolutely, lovely. Yeah. I'm sure it's lovely.
I love it. This is great. So you email Charlie. You're like, I have nothing going on as well. Let's go. And then somehow Will looks like he's a marauder. So tell me the next step. How does Will get involved, Tom? Or what happens next, Tom?
So
continue.
So I reach out to Charlie and say, do you want to actually do this thing? And he says, only if we can get Rory's permission, because didn't actually know it was Rory's idea at the time. I'd never heard of it. I thought it was Charlie's. So I said, should we do it? He said, reach out to Rory. And then if you do that, then we should do it. So I put it on LinkedIn. And I thought, I've seen these campaigns to try and get to celebrities happen before. Mm. So I thought, why not do it? Because the worst that could happen is it just falls into obscurity and no one sees it. Mm. So I post it on LinkedIn and it gets about 5,000 views, but if someone connects through an email like a few days later, but I went on Twitter or X and I said, I tweeted at Rory, can I have your blessing? And three people saw that tweet and one of them was Rory. And he said, yeah, blessed, off you go. So I went back to Charlie and I said, well, you know, we now need to do this thing. And I actually made a TikTok at the same time. And the part one TikTok got, it's on 250K views straight away. And then the second TikTok of, So that's how we knew it was going to work. Well, I say work. That's how we knew that people would actually like care about this thing. And then I made a part two, which was where Rory actually said yes. And that got another 100K or so. Both those videos today, 400K. That's on TikTok. And then on Instagram, it's on like 500K. This whole thing has got like 10 million impressions so far. So before, we took the idea, and then within a week of even like speaking to each other, we had about 400,000 impressions on social media about it. So that's how we knew that.
And this is the classic lean startup or startup engine playbook from 20 years ago, Lon, which was run some experiments, put up a landing page and see if anybody reacts to it. Right. In the modern era, it's let me make a launch video, let me do a TikTok, let me write a blog post, or let me do a creative brief. And then when you do that, if it gets energy, now you don't have to build it for $250,000 or $1 million and see if anybody responds to it. Yeah, you build it for 5 hours of work, 10 hours of work, see if anybody responds. And then if you get some energy back, you're like, wait a second, there's something here. Let's keep following, you know, what we're doing here.
100%. So I do a load of vibe coding as well. So like I vibe code websites, and then it's even easier to not even vibe code the website, just make a video about it. And you get the traction there.
So you're truly unemployed. Sort of you're like doubly unemployed. You're a vibe coder and you build websites.
That's right. I'll pitch you're for truly some work destitute on this show, right?
At this point.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So it's basically using the attention. It hasn't validated the business at all. Will the business work? Who knows? Mm-hmm. But it validates that people will actually like care about this thing. Mm-hmm. It validates the attention, and it's easier to sell something if it gets attention than not. So. It sort of worked out in the end.
It was multiple levels of focus group, because it was like Rory said this thing, and then these three random guys were like, hey, that sounds great. I would want to be involved in it. And then they start posting things, and other people are like, hey, that sounds great. It just the tale grows in the telling. At every level, more people get sucked in.
100%.
Like, such a simple concept.
Because when he said it, on the podcast, it went viral. When Charlie posted about it, it went viral. When I asked Rory, it didn't actually go viral. But there was two instances of it going viral, so it was a viral topic. And then I put the TikToks out and it went viral again. So you have instances of like those four viral videos.
And it's what the business was a creator on TikTok or X. They're like, if you have something that works, it goes viral, just retweak it a little bit and post it again. Like you already know it works. There's no reason not to like keep hitting it.
Well, what's so great about
this viral post on LinkedIn that I posted four times. It's gone viral and got 100,000 views every time.
Nobody remembers. You might as well keep going.
What's really interesting about this is it really goes back to memes and like really in the Marshall McLuhan, like 50 years ago memes.
Going way back.
Which is, the original idea was there was something inside of the idea that was so powerful that it would spread virally, you know, or like a virus from one brain to another, but it was contained. The idea was self-contained in as a unit, as a life form. And, you know, FWFO, just that phrase, flat white, F off, is such a concise, understandable way of demonstrating the tyranny of choice. Now, if I say tyranny of choice, that's also very appealing to people who are intellectual, et cetera, but it doesn't manifest itself in the same meme-like fashion. Tyranny of choice is a very famous study and an article from like HBS or, you know, these MBAs did, which I'm going to guess Will's the token MBA here, but I'm just taking a crazy guess. I think he's the business head because he looked very serious. But that tyranny of choice was they realized giving people, you know, 400 chairs to pick from, not a great idea.
It's what we say every time you log into Netflix. There's so much shows. There's so much content. You're like,
and what do people go to?
You get paralysis and you don't know what to choose.
Decision paralysis. Yeah. And what they realized was small, medium, large, and then maybe something for the whales that's off menu. So, or, you know, extremely high end, extremely budget, somewhere between the two. Right. So when you're booking a hotel room, they're like, here's the presidential suite. Here's the suite. It's $1,500 a night. Here's this like tiny little room in the back alley. Then here's the junior suite. And people are like, I'll go to the junior suite. It's got like it's got a desk. Right. Makes it just easier for people to quickly. Hey, I'm just going to be in the room for 8 hours. I'm overnight. I don't care. I'm not going to be working. I just want that one. I'll use the desk in the lobby. So anyway, the tyranny of choice. But just something about this meme specifically, flat white, which triggers something in your brain because you've heard of a flat white. It's a new beverage.
See, I was going to say
if you're
this
from America, and then F off is just...
I don't think this works with a latte. I don't think this works with an Americano. It's a flat white. It's like, oh, what is a flat white? Like, Americans, like, we've heard the term. We don't necessarily know exactly what it is, which makes it feel elite and special.
Well, it's even got a little bit of a punk rock thing. It's known for coming from Australia, but in fact, it was created in New Zealand. Anyway, I'll let the Kiwis and the Aussies fight it out.
Don't get into that controversy.
I'm not.
I don't want to know that one. Wow.
Yeah, it's just... when you're in Australia, people order flat whites and they are religious about it and they will comment on it and there's no other beverage. And if you order anything else, you're screwing up the queue.
It is insane because you talk about it as the meme, like there's flat white being that drink that's well known. And then you got Rory's involvement. Then you got the logo and the brand, which is looking, it looks amazing. Then you got the word in it as well. You have all these things that add together, like the perfect storm, really, that turn this thing into, that's why it keeps going viral all the time. I just mentioned on another podcast that we posted on Instagram, it's like 300,000 views now already. Like it just keeps going viral, this thing, just because, and like the way the words are laid out, just everything about it. We sort of locked onto the concept.
Well, to be clear, flat white is a double shot of espresso with like a micro foam, not like your cappuccino foam where you're like, is there any liquid here? I'm gonna tilt the cup back and it's gonna give me a mustache and then burn my lips off when the actual liquid comes. No, it's a micro foam. It's a very fine foam that is liquidy but foamy. It's like a 5 or 6 ounce drink.
New Zealand people will tell you that you can have an 12 ounce flat white because it's four shots of espresso with the rest of milk. So it's all about that ratio, like you said, the 2-to-1 ratio of milk to coffee. Then you know, again, we sort of get hung up on this. You know, we only serve one thing, flat whites, but. You know, we're also trying to get away from the pretentiousness of it and sort of say, you know, it's a milky coffee. You know, if you like a latte, a flat white is just a stronger taste. It's still a milky coffee at the end of the day. So we're trying to get past that almost snobbery that's come in the specialty coffee industry, especially with all these different customizations and roast levels and, you know, shots
it's
of
too
syrup
much.
And all that stuff. Yeah, it's just too much. Yeah. And we just want to get back to, again, a simple product that's done really well. And that's all we do.
We got all this momentum, and then me and Charlie were like, well, what do we actually do? Because you know, I've got no experience running a coffee shop. He's barista trained at Costa, but then we're like, what do we actually do? So we were thinking about what to do, and then I got a message in my TikTok DMs that said, "Hi Tom," and it was just that because TikTok doesn't let you send more than one message, and I hate ambiguity, so I responded. I just wanted to know what was going on, and it turned out it was Will's wife saying like, "We love the concept. We'd want to help out in any way we can." So I went across London and I saw that Grey Goose was doing an event where Will and Lucia were doing, and met them, saw the sort of production that they put on. So they run production. And then I called Charlie straight away and said, we need to get these guys involved because they could take this thing to actually be an incredible thing, which was the pop-up. They were behind it.
So
this is Will.
Will, you run an experiential marketing company. What's your story?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So I run... an experiential marketing agency called Ask the Impossible with my wife, Lucia, who reached out to Tom. And what we do, broadly speaking, is we translate the stories that brands want to tell in a variety of different ways. So PR stunts, marketing, experiential, whatever it might be, whatever story they want to tell, we work out the best way to tell it through production. And, you know, we know Rory, we know him now personally, but at the time we knew all of his concepts, principles. I'd read his book, I'd seen all his podcast he'd been on, and it just felt like a really lovely opportunity to get involved and try it. Do you know, as Charlie said earlier, put the test to the test. So it was, you know, we work with brands and we love our clients, but to be able to do something that's, you know, ours and sort of steer it, there was some, you know, some real joy in being able to do that.
Love it. So you connected with the concept, you're a fan of Rory's, and you maybe had some cycles and you're like, this would be a fun project to do.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I think so that, what happens next then? Okay. You had an insight into the brand itself?
Well, I mean, it's a bit of everything. So we, I mean, as I say, I mean, we love Rory, we love Rory's work, and we always try to apply it to the work that we do. And I guess the principle that I love most about Rory's thinking is when he talks about creativity to go viral is about pattern disruption. So you have to do something really unusual, unexpected, in some ways completely insane to capture the attention and the imagination of people. And I guess that's what we've done with Flat White, is do something that's if everyone's operating over here doing the same thing, demonstrably the same thing, and then you're operating over here doing something completely different, not only does the attention shift to you because there is no one else, there is no one else over here doing their thing, but also it allows you to do what you like. It has a sort of freedom. And it's not Rory, but it's Will Goddara, but Rory talks about him a lot. And he says, don't go to your competition and figure out what they're doing well and then copy it. Go and figure out what they're not doing well and then do so much better. But yes, then also do all the other stuff really well. So that's,
I had Will on this podcast.
That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, that insight was a very interesting one to me, Lon. I had Will on the podcast. He's got that great book, Unreasonable Hospitality.
Right.
Actually, I think it was in The Bear as well. And some of the stories were in there. So the story in The Bear where they go out and get the pizza and then bring it so they don't miss Chicago deep dish,
right,
was something from 11 Madison.
Oh, and, I didn't realize that's a true story.
11 Madison, they overheard. They had this really great moment, Will and Lon, where they would try to like overhear conversations. They would eavesdrop. And they heard, and they always were aware that when people showed up with their luggage, that they were a VIP in some way because they either got off the airplane and came to 11 Madison. It was the first thing they wanted to do, or it was something they absolutely couldn't miss, to the point at which they brought their luggage to the thing and snuck in 11 Madison before they left the city, New York. And one of these people who was leaving New York said, we did everything. We hit everything. We did Broadway shows, the Central Park. The only thing we didn't have, one person said jokingly, was a dirty water hot dog. Will Goddara sends somebody, goes running out into Madison Square Park. There's a dirty water hot dog. He buys 4 dirty water hot dogs, runs them back to the thing, and they deconstruct them, put the greatest mayonnaise, they elevate it, blah, 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 and then they drop it and say, we didn't want you to leave New York without having a dirty water hot dog elevated with truffles and caviar or whatever. Boom, breaks people's brains. But the story you're referring to, Will, is they took everybody to the number one restaurant. I don't know if it was Nome at the time or whatever it was. And they said, just write down what didn't work or what sucked. And I think one of the guys wasn't a wine drinker. A lot of chefs are into beer. And he tried to get a beer and they're like, yeah, we have this beer. Like they have a beer at a Michelin star restaurant. And then their guy was like, hey, yeah, you know, what kind of coffee do they have? They're like, yeah, we have coffee, you know, like you can have espresso, flat white, whatever. But they didn't like know what the beans were or whatever. They get back. They say, okay, you are the beer sommelier. You are the coffee sommelier. When we go, we say, would you like a wine or would you like to talk to the sommelier for wine or sommelier for beer? And then like, there's one person in every party. It's like, you have a beer sommelier? I've never experienced that before. That was the magic. Yeah, Will?
Exactly that. Yeah. In the cafe industry, I guess that's why we get the little cards where you get the stamp. Yes. And as a great web, she calls herself the web psychologist. Her name's Natalie Nahaya. She writes a great book on online psychology and how to encourage people to, you know, navigate websites the right way and click buttons and so forth. And, you know, place it in a different place and it encourages people to click it more and all that sort of stuff. And she said that when it comes to the journey of that little stamp card, if they give you one stamp, you're more likely to throw it away than if you give they give you, say, 3 stamps of the 10. Because once you're into that journey, you want to then complete the journey.
Oh, yeah. So the so trick is to give you 3.
Give you a couple extra. They give you a couple extra. Genius. And they pretend they're being generous, but actually you're more likely to then complete that journey of getting the stamps.
Now you've got 2 partners in crime, maybe 3 with Will's wife, and you're off to the races. What happens next?
Will and Lucia came on board. We had the production, we had the design, and we had the content creator that is Tom. All great recipes for a great, successful viral brand. So we get going, we start delving into the coffee industry, you know, because again, we're all really from marketing and sort of design backgrounds. None of us are in the coffee world. So it's really important to us to really educate ourselves on that. If we're going to do one thing, we have to do it really, really well. So yeah, we get going, we move on, and we get a partnership with a place called Fireheart Roastery. You know, when we were looking for the perfect bean for the flat white, we had quite, you know, big interest in brands. You know, a lot of people are interested in this brand from an industry perspective. You know, they're not used to this speciality of just doing one thing. You know, the margins in coffee are ridiculous. People often say we're actually quite insane, restricted down to one thing, and still to be determined whether that's right or wrong yet. But Yeah, did loads of coffee tasting, picked the beans, and then it was all about the production then of getting the physical space ready, the activation of how we're going to first tell the joke of Flat White or Fuck Off. And we had a location. It was at Russell Square. It was something that me and Tom acquired before Will and Lucia came on board. But what we realized quite quickly was the momentum was growing so much and it was going at such rapid pace that we had to up our expectations. We moved to a bigger location, Outranet, which has a massive screen place in London, Tottenham Court Road. You know, we were thinking we would get 600 people in a day. We were upping that to 1,500. So 8 days out, yeah, we really upped our expectations. And it was a lot of sleepless nights getting the graphics ready for the screens. Will, I know for a fact, the production went into overdrive just before then.
I think it was 8 days out, wasn't it, Charlie?
What was people's reaction? And did people come up and ask for a non-flat white to experience everybody yelling F off?
Yes. Yes, they did. A lot of people did. They loved it.
Yeah. A lot of people walked past, they looked in, they saw it, and they're like, oh, is that actually what's going to happen? And I said, yeah, I always remember there was a 70-year-old woman. And she was like, no, there's no way you'd say that if I asked for something different. I said, well, go on. Go and see. And she did, and she got her fuck off. And then she loved it so much, she then actually went and bought a flat white. She wasn't a flat white drinker. But it, and weirdly, it's the older generation that liked this way more than everyone else. Didn't realize that until the day. But there were quite a few who asked for it.
One of the standouts for me was when the police entered the space, and we were like, uh-oh.
Oh, boy.
What? Like, oh, no. Are they going to tell us that we Section 5 Public Order Act? I'm sorry, you're going to have to come with us situation. but no, they asked for cappuccinos and lattes. We told them to fuck off. We gave them some lattes and they had a great time.
I love it.
It was the biggest F off of the day, I believe. The baristas behind the bar really said it with their chests.
Well, the fiery guns over there.
I don't know if you know the Wieners circle, since we're deep into this stuff. Yeah, but they're behind the counter and whatever... You know, you come up and you order and they just roast you and they just abuse you to a level that is like Triumph the Insult Comic Dog. I don't know if you guys know that Conan O'Brien skit, but
I want to have a cheeseburger.
Extra juice.
That's probably why we didn't. Wow. That was probably why we didn't. I'm going to need to bleep that one out. Wow. So that's that. We can take that off the screen for now. We have to bleep that in post. Yeah. Well, we'll bleep it out. Just bleep it. It'll be fine.
It was the one thing 11 Madison Park didn't serve up.
Yeah.
It's worth mentioning that this is a barista's dream. They love this. All the baristas want to do is help them to go away. That's it. That's literally it. So they dreamed about it.
You must
have
had
that dream job.
You must have had the conversation that it would be interesting, funny, at some point to add a skew, to add an option or not. So how do you think about somebody saying, I'm lactose intolerant?
Well, we do offer oat milk. So we do offer an alternative milk. So we had this conversation with Rory when we met him. He was a bit flabbergasted at first when we said we were going to do oat milk and dairy milk because his idea was purely flat whites. And we sort of tried to negotiate with him in a way. It was kind of interesting trying to talk to the man himself of, you know, human behavior about this sort of thing. Well, you're alienating an audience so much to milky coffee that it doesn't feel very fair for people that are lactose intolerant. They can't enjoy the brand as well. You've got to have some way of flexing around those dietary requirements. Now, your answer to putting a latte on there or, you know, a black coffee, the answer's in the name. You know, I feel like the name really resonates that if we lose that part, you just end up like everyone
else. So decaf, F off or?
F off.
Oh, yeah.
F off, right? If it's a full F off. Wow.
Even in a normal coffee shop, it's an interesting one. F off.
So
it's interesting because in the summer maybe we have an iced flat white because it's still a flat white. We still need to discuss this.
We're working on it.
It was
really interesting in oh, you go, Will.
Go on, Tom. No, you go, Tom.
So polite.
The really interesting thing when we when the first videos went viral, we got so many comments, and a lot of those comments were asking about the milk. So, like, we'd be idiots to, like, avoid the customer feedback. Like, it was overwhelming. There must have been, I don't know, most those two videos each got probably 200 comments, and like 50 of them were talking about the milk. And it, you know, it's, we're still making flat whites with oat milk. They're still, it's still the drink.
I think that's it's a category. Yeah, it's like if I get a latte and I put soy milk in it, that's still a latte.
Here's the, I'll give the counter argument. I'm going to take the other side of this one. I know I'm outnumbered. People who order oat milk are generally annoying virtue signaling hippies.
Some people and just have trouble with
sorry, dairy. I don't know. I get the feeling.
A dairy person.
Well, I don't care.
Some people get a funny tummy.
Okay, that's my point. Let Jason talk. Then you gotta, let Jason give his point.
It's fine. I know that there's probably some hippy dippies here on the program who, but you want to tell them to F off strictly because they will lose their minds and say, but my tummy, but I object to cows, and you know, cows are tortured and blah, blah, blah. And you say, yeah, we love to torture cows to get the milk. That's what we do here. And then you just, it gives you another level of dunking, and those people will be the most vocal and offended and will spread the meme.
Well, we're not looking to be vocated. Yeah.
I would say a lot of people are disagreeing with us still about just doing one thing. I don't think we need to get that controversial. We're still getting a lot of people to this day moaning about the fact we only do a flat white.
Yeah, I feel like maybe I'm taking it too far.
In time, we can goad more people, but for now,
we can always bring up our political opinions and put that on the ground as well to get extra controversy.
Donald Trumper, F off. That's what it's. Yeah, I would. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Well, no, the if reason we really want to get canceled,
yeah.
And when people come up and they order one, are they getting theirs that was ordered at that time and it goes in the queue, or are they just queuing flat whites and you just walk up and grab one?
Yes and no. So the percentage we discovered of flat dairy to oat is about 60% dairy to 40% oat.
Oh, wow, higher than
so proportionally, it's about, I mean, just under half and half. So one of the ways we wanted to interrogate and test Rory's theories is, well, firstly, you can't make a flat white. You can't sit there and wait and then someone picks it up 5 minutes later, because after a couple of minutes, it's too cold, it's too dead, it's too, well, pun intended, flat. The bubbles deflate. It tastes disgusting. So you kind of have to make it live, but there's an onus on speed and we have to make them fast. So once a queue starts to build and we rationalize this whole process, once someone appears for the queue, you know they're having a coffee, because we don't do anything else. They're not asking for anything other than the coffee.
Right. And so you got a 50-50 shot, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we can start grinding the beans. We can start making the coffee. We can put the running the espresso through. And by the time they've tapped and paid, their coffee is ready, or the espresso is ready, and it's just a question of oat and dairy. And then in theory, if we've got five or six, let's say for easy maths, 10 people deep queue, we know about six are going to order a dairy and about four are going to order an oat. Genius. So we just slightly overestimate. And then by the time those 10 have progressed through the queue, a few more have joined. So it's just a case of keeping up with the numbers. But one of the funniest things about all the Brits love a queue, but also they hate there to not be a queue because they don't want to be the first in. So whilst we wanted to do things really quickly, we also needed to offer a few free coffees to the first few people just to get it going. So otherwise,
what's the optimal queue? What's optimal queue, Will?
I mean, it varies. For our pop up, 10 or 15 people. I mean, we got the service time down to about 15, 20 seconds of flat white.
Wow. I heard you say you got Rory's blessing, but who owns this business? What's the equity? This is America. You're an American program. We talk about these things. I know in England, everything's like, oh, well, the king owns a piece, the queen owns a piece, this prince owns a piece, and then we, are servants to the queen, and we genuflect, and we get a pittance. This is America. We talk cap tables here. You guys are all equity partners here. Tom is your idea. I don't know. Charlie, who owns third, what?
Third, and third.
And what does Rory own?
The idea.
Just gave you, he just gave you his blessing?
Wow. Nothing.
Yeah, we just gave it up. We have had conversations with him loads about it and where it was going and stuff. And he's just really happy to see the idea come to life. Okay. I mean, I think Rory's got a lot going on, and he's always happy to give us his time in absolute abundance. You know, every time we meet him, it's a mini podcast in itself.
We got to fix this. Here's what I want you to do. I'm going to throw this up the flagpole. We'll see if anybody salutes. I want you to take 1% off the top and tell Rory, we're reserving 1% royalty to you forever, like the McDonald's brothers didn't get from Ray Kroc and he screwed them out of. You're going to do a reverse Ray Kroc, and you're going to tell him, we're going to put this 1% into an annuity. It's going to be like a trust You take it or you don't. You tell us who to donate it to, but we're giving you the 1% royalty forever. And that's the royalty royal trust. You know, like you have the Queen's Trust and all this other stuff and whatever. You're just saying this is the Rory Trust.
We're going to call it the Royalty.
Oh, the Royalty. Thank you. So this is like, now we've got a real name. We've got a Royalty.
Just know that if you take any of Jason's ideas, this is what he's going to charge you. There's no free ride.
I understand.
There's no stop by your pop-up and give you some advice. It's 1%.
No, you put Rory in an impossible position, because if he says he wants a piece, then it doesn't. It's not very Rory-esque. That's not his vibe. So you have to force it on him and say, Rory, there's a Rory T for you. It's in the Royal Trust. The Rory Trust. Take it or leave it. We're going to put it in there. And it's going to be on the website. And it's just going to grow over time. People can figure out our revenue because it's 1% royalty. And we're just going to skim it off the top and put it in there. That's it.
This is a very expensive podcast appearance for these guys.
Well, I don't care. I think it's killer. I think it'll drive 10% more usage of the brand.
We're going to have a hard time booking the show if it's 1% off the top.
No, the brand goes 10% more. Yeah. Go ahead.
Jason, you said you like the idea and you think it's going to work. If you invest in us, we'll consider that, yeah.
Okay. I'll invest in this, I think. Well, I need to know the economics of this. You know, there's the format, the next level of this is figuring out the overhead, because coffee is an overhead game.
Of course.
And it's a price per square foot game. So you have to make a really thoughtful decision here if this is going to be a third space where people hang, and if it's a destination where, or it's a commuter thing. And if then you're going to have to be as ruthlessly about that as you are about the menu. So if this is truly ruthless capitalism, then what's the minimum square footage and the cheapest way to provide the service to the most people, which would be some sort of algorithm of lowest square footage, highest foot traffic. And that's like a kiosk or whatever. And the way you know this was, there was some sort of, I got pitched on this, which was a mobile bicycle with a coffee set up on the front, and you would drive it and park it places. So not even a food truck version, but a mobile bicycle version. And I don't know if that ever worked out, but that's where we have to put our thinking caps on, because once you get a rent, once you have $10K a month in rent, the idea blows up. It's just not going to work. And then you need to add SKUs, right? Let's talk offline. I'll have you guys back on. I think we need to answer that question. This has been amazing. Guys, congratulations on finding employment in two of your cases. I think this actually,
congratulations on your investment.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me know who to make it out to. Is it Will's wife? Is it Tom's Bitcoin wallet? Where am I sending this this investment?
But cash in the post.
Go and follow Flat White or F Off on Instagram. Just search for it. They have an incredible Instagram. I think I could raise a syndicate for this. I think I could put in like 100K myself. I might need to do it personally. Because it's outside of what I do, but I think I would put like 100K personally and then raise $1 million for my syndicate.
That's what Jacob was saying. We're going to put coffee in our core six at launch.
No, definitely not. It's not that kind of business. But I get with the syndicate. I've got a bunch of lunatic investors who might be interested in doing this. Time for your favorite.
My favorite.
Your
part
favorite.
Of the week. Off duty.
Yeah, me too. It's a great way to end the week.
So I do, before we get into streaming recommendations, I do have a few. I wanted to talk about, it's the Oscars on Sunday, Jason. I don't know if you knew, the Oscar ceremony is coming up.
I
saw that you entered our Oscar pool. So I just want to, real quick, what do you think of the crop this year? What's your pick for Best Picture? Have you seen a bunch of the Oscar movies?
I haven't seen enough of them.
Here's the Best Picture nominees: Secret Agent, Begonia, Marty Supreme, Train Dreams, F1, Sinners, Frankenstein, Hamnet, One Battle After Another, Sentimental Value. I know you saw One Battle because we saw it together.
Yes, we saw it together. I think Sinners and One Battle are going to sweep the whole thing because, you know, the Oscars is a very political, woke, virtue signaling, hand-wringing, precious kind of thing. They want to feel good about who they pick. And I tried to watch Sinners twice and it just was so boring at the start. I couldn't get through it.
It's great.
You know what the problem is? I think, and in fairness to the film, both times I watched it was on a plane. And a plane is suboptimal. I have to watch it.
It's such a musical
in my movie.
You got to watch it with the good sound so you can hear the songs.
I have a movie theater in the ski house. That's where I do most of my watching. I did go to the theater to see Begonia, and I was fascinated by that film. Very art house, very experimental. So I like that that exists. On Paul Thomas Anderson films, One Battle After Another would be in my bottom, like way down on the bottom of my list.
Oh, I liked it.
Because, listen, there were aspects of it I liked, but I think people like it for the wrong reason.
Mm.
I think it appeals to the left because they think it's like a rallying cry kind of a film about this moment in time, and they think it's actually anti-right. What I took from it was horseshoe theory. All the extremists are giant losers.
Sure.
With nothing going on in their life. The left and the right are both idiots on this, like, horseshoe theory when they, like, both extremes
are retarded. I think that's fair. I mean, it's about how hard it is to sort of live these principles all the time. That, like, you know, like, DiCaprio, he's part of this revolutionary movement, but there are indications that he also just likes the ladies, and he's a big part of it.
Yes.
He's sort of in it for himself. And when it comes down to the family, that's the divide. Is Teyana Taylor's character, Perfita Beverly Hills, she's so committed to the cause that she's like, I'm going to leave my child. I'm going to leave this life.
Right.
I'm
she's an actual believer.
Activism, and then you get him, and it's sort of like, well, not really. He wasn't really that committed. He just liked
and the other
lifestyle.
Guy on the right, played by Sean Penn, is also in it to meet hot chicks.
Personal, so, right. It's about himself and his ego, and he wants to be part of this elite.
But it's also
society.
About hot chicks, and it's like when you look at movements like this, and you look at or like cults and this kind of thing. A lot of times it's like really loser guys who are just don't have game with girls, who are trying to meet girls or try to status whatever. Anyway, I didn't like the film. For that reason.
I think all that's in there, but I do think, like, Sensei Carlos, like, Benicio del Toro's character, like, he's a heroic character, and he is associated with these left-wing sort of protest
movements. Definitely is trying to actually accomplish something.
Right. I think that's
White privilege.
Exactly. That's the dynamic between him and DiCaprio, is this guy's put so much work into this. He's got this whole
setup. Yes, it matters to him.
But,
with the two white characters, they're just in it, like, they have white privilege and they have the ability. Yeah. Like, it's actually giving the opposite message. These people just have privilege. They can F around and be part of movements because they have options in life. And if it doesn't work out, they can always go back to their next option.
Yeah, it's an interesting critique. I think that's, I think I can see both sides of this argument.
Anyway,
but
it's not a great film.
It's pretty good. It's really
It's a good film. It's not great. And when you cannot put this film anywhere near The Master, which is his masterpiece, or There Will Be Blood, which is what other people would consider his masterpiece. It's one of those two.
There Will Be Blood is my favorite. Yeah.
Okay, fine. I flip flop between those two. What's your number three then? Is it Master? There Will Be Blood, The Master, and then.
I mean, I think I would, I would probably go like Boogie Nights versus One Battle is sort of right there. I like Phantom Thread a lot too. They're all great. It's hard
for me to
put
this film.
Licorice Pizza is the only one that I didn't like.
You cannot put this film anywhere near Boogie Nights. It is a steep drop off after
Boogie
Nights.
I don't know. That the road scene is really great. Well, we can talk
I think that's what's going to win. Then I think it's, a bunch of the Sinners actors win. I think the Oscar's So White thing is still in people's brains. So I think that
best actress will probably be Jesse Buckley from Hamnet or Rose Byrne from If I Had Legs I'd Kick You, which is great. I like that one a lot too.
I need to see that one. That one looks like
it's
it would
on
be appealing
HBO Max
to me.
Now. That one's on HBO Max.
I love
Max,
Rose Byrne. Anyway, so the Oscars to me has never been relevant, not since
fair enough.
It used to be like we could sit there and be like, well, Dances with Wolves or Goodfellas, like these are, I don't know. It just feels like it's not about cinema. I'm in the Bret Easton Ellis.
There's a lot of politics to it as well.
It's
correct.
Not enough about the films and the actual performances, because if it was, then certain things would just break out. Like the fact that, what was the Scorsese film that just got totally snubbed?
Killers of the Flower Moon or Wolf of Wall Street?
Right,
just Wolf of Wall Street.
Because like who in this climate, who could vote for that? It's like, a bunch of like, white guys doing cocaine and stealing money from retail investors. Like, it makes no sense that, like, there's nobody likable in that. It doesn't fit any of the garbles. Anyway, I'm going to put it all aside. What do you think is going to be the two biggest winners in total Oscars? I'm going to say One battle after the other is going to get the most Oscars, and yeah, right behind it, Sinners. Like, they'll get like five or six each.
Probably. I think that is five probably or six right. Each. I think it's probably going to be about three or four for Sinners, and one battle is going to do very well. Looks like probably, I would say, supporting actor, they've got a good chance. Obviously, screenplay, okay, director, picture, they're going to get a lot of the big ones.
Did you see the Frankenstein movie yet?
I've seen all 10. I've seen all the Oscar nominees.
What's up with the Frankenstein movie? I like...
It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. It looks amazing. The sets are incredible.
I like Maggie
Gyllenhaal.
The makeup's
incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, no, that's two different movies. Maggie Gyllenhaal did a movie called The Bride with her and Christian Bale.
Oh, where it's like this is a different film.
Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein is a much more faithful adaptation. It does take some liberties. It's a faithful adaptation of the book.
Now I understand why I'm so confused, because I saw the whole press tour for Maggie. I did see the first 15 minutes of the Frankenstein one.
Right. That's the one with Oscar Isaac as Victor Frankenstein and Jacob Elordi is the creature. That one's more like the book. The Bride is like this feminist 20th century reimagining that gets real freaky, and it's all different. It's more
like a
comedy.
For me to get through films now, I have to go to the movie theater.
It's tough. It's tough at home. There's a lot of distractions.
Too many distractions.
Especially now that we've got all the devices and everything, you're constantly being
I'm now going to make the commitment that I'm just going to go see the Oscar films in theaters from now on. I'm just going to do that.
I think that makes a lot of sense. It's hard sometimes with the Netflix ones, but otherwise you can make it. I saw Secret Agent at the Austin Film Society. Shout out to the
I really
want to
see that one too, yeah.
That
one's
great.
What else you got?
One more thing I wanted to talk about at the Oscars. Did you see this Timothée Chalamet, your buddy Timmy? Did you see he got in trouble for this clip that's going around? It's him talking to Matthew McConaughey. And it's
Let me hear the clip. I know the clip, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, we'll pull the clip up. This is from one of those variety, like, actors on actors kinds of discussions.
I admire people, and I've done it myself, to go on a talk show and go, hey, we got to keep movie theaters alive. You know, we got to keep this genre alive. And another part of me feels like, if people want to see it, like Barbie, like Oppenheimer, they're going to go see it and go out of their way to be loud and proud about it. And I don't want to be working in ballet or opera or, you know, things where it's like, hey, keep this thing alive, even though no one cares about this anymore. All respect to the ballet and opera people out there. I just lost 14 cents in viewership. But
I mean, it's 100% accurate.
It's a
100% accurate. And he even contextualized it at the end. There's no reason to cancel him. The ballet people, the opera people, are admittedly trying to bring in a new audience. That's what they themselves talk about. He's not speaking out of school.
Yeah,
and he is being humble and saying cinema is having the same issue, that new options, and cinema did it to ballet and opera and theater. That was the same complaint people made about movies. These are taking away from the ballet, taking away from the theater.
Oh, it's going to kill movies.
Yes, you know, more options.
And I agree. It's such an obvious thing. And all the people who are getting mad, Doja Cat, actually, you know Doja Cat, the rapper and singer, she was one of the people on social media who was like, this idiot, ballet is amazing and opera, how dare you? And then just today she was like, you know what? She reposted. She's like, you know what? I don't go see opera and ballet. I don't know why I said that about him. I was just jumping, getting mad on social media for no reason. And I think that was a lot of it. Like, how many people are actually paying? If this many people were really that passionate about opera, opera would be huge. You'd constantly be talking about the new operas. Like, I don't think most people could name more than a few operas.
I mean, I can. Puccini, like I can tell you, Madame Butterfly.
Like The Marriage of Figaro is one, Carmen is one. But like, I'm not, none of us are experts. It doesn't mean you hate it. You just say like most Americans aren't super into opera. That's just true.
All right, I'm going to give you one. This is like out of left field. It's off duty. I, you know, would love a Cherry Coke back in the day.
Ooh, yeah.
You know,
delicious.
Ever have a nice cold Cherry Coke?
Cherry flavored sodas. I'm a big fan.
Now, I also stopped drinking caffeine in the afternoons. So, I love Coke Zero. So I get Coke Zero and I get caffeine free. Mm-hmm. But when I was in Italy, I kept seeing these, this brand, Toshi cherries.
Amarena Toshi cherries. Yeah.
Yes. And, they come in an iconic, there's a very iconic, you know, bottle that these kind of cherries come in from Italy. I sent you like the one I buy that's at scale. Like, right, it's a large Porsche. These are not cheap. Let me tell you that. These are not maraschino cherries. These are like cocktail cherries, right? And they're very expensive. Luxardo makes them. And then there's like Amarena wild cherries.
Amarena is the one you sent us, yeah.
Yes, and they come in fancy bottles. Anyway, I order this in bulk, and I will make a little cherry soda for my girls, where I will take a little sparkling water, some crushed ice.
Sure.
And I put some of the syrup in from this and the cherries. They love it. I'll drop it into my, in the afternoons, caffeine-free, whatever, and put it on there. But you can also put it on vanilla ice cream. And when I was in Italy, I would order black cherry gelato. And I kept going back to the place, and they would give it to me. And then I looked, and I couldn't find it in the counter. I said, oh, you have no more black cherry? They're like, no, we have black cherry. I'm like, where is it? She's like, well, we take this vanilla one. And then they had the giant thing of these Amarena cherries, and we just put a scoop of them on top. I was like, oh, wow.
Delicious, yeah.
That's how you make it. So I make this at home. And I went back to the same place in Florence, like literally with my daughters, like every day.
I'm going to check this out.
I'll send you the place. I would go like twice a day. Every day I would go, they would just hand me my thing. They knew I was going to order black cherry for myself. And every day they would put more on it. And then I came back the fourth day, and the woman's, you know, like, how long are you staying? I'm like, actually, we're leaving tomorrow, whatever. She put so many cherries on top of this. She goes, thank you for coming, because I was giving me, I'm a big tipper. Yeah. She put like 20 cherries on top of it, scoop of ice cream on top of that, then more cherries. I've made a total sundae for me. I'm addicted to them. You'll love them.
Yeah, that sounds
delicious.
Treat
your family. Delicious. Yeah.
Love it. There was a yogurt shop in LA called Humphrey Yogurt. I don't think it's still there, but that's what they used to do. There were no flavors. It was just plain vanilla, but then they would put the toppings in and like mix it up, and that would be how you do your flavor. So it was like Butterfinger flavor, Snickers flavor, cherry flavor, all that kind of stuff. Really good. You made me nostalgic for it.
There it is.
Humphrey Yogurt. There you go.
Okay.
There is a documentary on Netflix right now that Louis Theroux did. You know Louis Theroux, he's this British TV. He does interviews, but he picks like the Westboro Baptists or this group of white supremacists. Like he interviews fringe people and kind of brings this very mainstream sort of mindset. Like, I want to understand your group and how you think. He's done a whole bunch of these for BBC and different films over the years. So his new one is on Netflix, and he goes to visit a bunch of Manosphere guys, like not Andrew Tate, but guys in the Andrew Tate sort of vein who are like coaching young boys how to be anti-feminist or how to be, you know, like you gotta be one-way monogamous. My girl doesn't cheat on me, but I can sleep with whoever I want. Like guys like Sneeko and all that. It's really interesting. And I think he does a good job of showing how a lot of these people with these big TikTok and Instagram accounts, it's not reality. Like it's like reality TV. They're playing a character. Everything is sort of set up to be filmed. And when you go meet the real guys, they're not these guys they're playing on social media. And I think it does a really good job of sort of getting them to reveal their who they really are, that and that this is all an act, and that they're selling, you know, they're selling supplements, they're selling come join my Telegram, get this
app. Of course.
App.
I mean, half of people's opinions now are based on the algorithm. And so if you want to understand, you know, I'm not singling anybody out, but I don't know, maybe the most extreme would be on the political side. There are a group of people who are like just all in on Trump, right?
Yeah.
Like Michael Wolff, and they just are, you know, releasing content every day about Michael Wolff. Michael Wolff and Joanna Kearns from Daily Beast are just constantly doing Trump stuff, right? And it's kind of anti. And then on the other side, you have the Candace Owens of the world and Fuentes. Like, they know that there's certain keywords, whether it's like anti-Semitic stuff, or they go after Charlie Kirk is going to feed the algorithm. And it's just algorithm feeding. And it's a volume game, and it's a titles game. And that's the challenge of like being a media consumer today, is looking at the content and saying, is that person trying to get massive amounts of views by keyword stuffing and feeding the algorithm at this moment in time? Or are they authentically interested in it? When you look at us and we talk about OpenClaw and we talk about Tao as like two of the things that we've been covering here a lot on the show. It's because I personally find these things very interesting in terms of the future of technology. Some people might not be interested in them at all. Or I see, you know, the flat white thing. I'm like, oh, there's something interesting going on here. I build this show not to feed the algorithm, but based on my own personal view of what's fascinating. And then that's what I've charged you and the team with doing. Hey, find me fascinating stuff that's groundbreaking. And when we find something that's particularly fascinating, I want to double down on it and until it becomes not interesting.
Yeah.
Makes sense. I think that's not the winning strategy.
Well, maybe for YouTube. I mean, I think you have a special because you're sort of well known outside of this. And so we have like some advantages that a lot of other creators don't have. But when you watch guys like that's a guy named HS Tiki Talky who's on TikTok. They are purely slaves to the algorithm. They're just doing things. They're seeing which things that they could do will get the most people to follow them on Kick or Rumble, to tune in when they start streaming, and like they're gonna do whatever those things are, and like that's a lot of what I think Louis is showing in the film. Is like, it sounds like they sound so confident, they sound so brash, they sound like they're coming up with all this stuff off the top of their head and they're desperate to share it with you because it's important life strategies, but then you take a closer look and it's like they're purely just doing what works and what's going to add up to the most clicks and what's going to get them the most attention because they're trying to sell you a subscription to this or this gambling site or whatever.
Great to work with you, Lon. As always, have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.